And then there was one. My name is Jeanette Manning, and I am an alcoholic. So today, only because of God and sponsorship, my sobriety date is the 28th of August of 1988. And for that, I owe you my life. This is too funny. You know, many people know that John and Cindy are great heroes of mine, and looking out at you, I know they must be for you too. When John asked me to come participate in this, I hung up on him. We had a bad connection. He was like out on a ranch or something. But between Joe and Cindy, we got tracked down and we got taken care of with me getting to be here tonight with you, and I'm just thrilled beyond belief, overwhelmed and delighted. Nothing I can do to ever thank you enough. It's truly, I am living a dream I never knew I had. I never knew I wanted to stand in front of a group of people that know me so intimately and that I love tremendously, fully clothed. And, you know, that greeting is original, and I'll tell you what, the boys in North Dakota are really giving me a run for your money, and I just think you guys are often duplicated, but just never replicated. I mean, I remember Richard and Carlene dragging us to Billings, you know, when Clancy was coming, or some other festive occasion, and being trapped in the back of a van. Yeah, I was trapped in the back of a van this afternoon, and I was so thrilled to reach our compadre sat there. So thank you to all of you, you know, for the example and the demonstration of your action in AAA, and let's get drunk, you know, so that's what we're here to talk about. Stephanie, God bless her, she called me, tracked me down in Helena the other day and asked me what I like to drink. Jack Daniels? Johnny Walker Red, Jim Beam, Vermouth, Gas, and as that rapidly went through my head, I said, water will be fine. She's really going to be thinking, what are you doing to me? I didn't want to scare her too much, but I do. If I could golf with any kind of, like, consistency, I think that could be really good, because I want to just hammer that ball and you don't get arrested. Because usually when I hit people, I get arrested. So, yeah, I'll tell you what, I am the skinny little Indian girl from the wrong side of the tracks. I was raised in Butte, Montana. I spent a lot of my formative years there down off 813 Colorado is where we lived, behind Jerry's Corner Bar, off of Main Street. And my father was a hard-drinking man. You know, he carried a 357, and there was a lot of excitement and adventure going on in our home. Furniture flew a lot. And the cops were often there because my dad was a Vietnam vet. And so if you have any experience with that, I'll tell you what, there's always excitement happening Friday night, Tuesday night in my home. Wednesday afternoon, he would go to commando and, like, walk down the house and barricade the windows. And as a kid, I don't remember really understanding a lot of it other than he just was really tortured. And I didn't understand that, you know. I just thought that he was a jerk and a creep, and I wish that he would leave us alone and stop drinking. And I was never going to drink. I was never going to be like him. And, you know, luckily today I'm delighted that I am just like him, that we share this disease. And I don't remember my drink. I wish I could tell you a fabulous, you know, getting to know you story about the first time that I drank. I don't have one. I remember being 6 years old upstairs in the attic of that house on Colorado Street, and I am first and foremost a pyromaniac. And I'm concerned about the forest today, so please put your cigarettes down, stand on and crush them, you know, carry them around in the pop can. Because I, he demands I owe for, I've torched a few things in my day. And at that time in my life, I was lighting plastic straws on fire upstairs in the attic, and I would let the melted plastic drip onto my skin. And I had these dime-sized little scars all over my knees, where it was like the first relief I could get. You know, before I knew I'd feel better if I hit somebody or if I was having gas or anything, that was my first relief, was just, God, I can't stand me. And I often tell you, it's before any sexual abuse, it's before any physical abuse, it's before any of the stuff that I got some people with in the spring of 1988, convinced that that's what was wrong with me, was all of that. Not that I was just untreated alcoholism. Not that I take a drink of alcohol, something happens to and for me. I tell you, man, I'm John Wayne and Marilyn Monroe. You know, stand back, and I got it going on, and I love it, and I can't wait to do it again. And And so I didn't get a slow dance with alcoholism. I really didn't. It was just like I always drank. And I always drank really well. I really feel sorry for people who have to, you know, find the occasion to drink, you know, the wine salons or, you know, stopping after the bar, you know, at the bar after work for a drink. I just got to drink. And I did everything I could to protect that. Now, of course, I was 11 years old, so you have to work kind of at that. I love this podium. There's a big shelf down here, and I have 2 bottles of water on it. They're both mine. I just stopped the bar before I got here. But that's pretty much what happened. I started drinking, and I started doing all kinds of things. But you know what? I'll preface this. I'll give you kind of a little frame of reference, and it's my favorite story to tell. It kind of set the mood. I'm 10 years old, maybe 9 years old. I don't know. I'm a little kid. I'm very little. And I was in Butte. And, you know, I'm 1 of 7 kids. I have 4 brothers and 2 sisters. And crazy drinking Butte mining town. I'll tell you what, the town went to pot in 81 when they outlawed prostitution. And I was out of a job career. You know, that was like, going to grow up and work on Maine. But what I was doing as a little kid in Butte, Montana, is I was shining shoes. And I was at the M&M Bar, and I was at the shanty, and I was, you know, all over that town. A little shoe shanty, and me and my friend Tracy Foster would be all over there making some money, man. And I went to my neighbor's house one day. Her name was Erin, and she was, you know, her house was perfect and immaculate. They had grass in the front, you know, and their gate worked. You know, ours was kind of like hanging on by like a screw or something. And I loved going to her house. She had a basset hound, and she had an over-frosted glass pane on her front door, and it was like stepping through the looking glass. You know, her life was really wonderland. And I was hanging out at her house one day, and we were busted into the pantry to have some snack foods, because she had Twinkies and Pringles and all the really good food, right? And I opened this can of Pringles, and it was 3 quarters filled with marijuana seeds. And I tell you what, I do not know how I intuitively knew what they were. I just knew what they were. And all of a sudden, I thought, I got to bring some of these to Main Street Park. I put them into a Ziploc bag in this little, you know, the Playtex nurses that they stick into the baby bottle. I filled up one of those, packed them in my pocket. I'm not kidding you, I was walking up to my house 3 blocks away like Jerry Cooper. I could not believe it. My good fortune had finally smiled upon me at last. I was going to take them to Main Street Park. The big kids were going to be out at 3:15, and they were going to want what I had. And as I'm crossing over into my front lawn, I think, I should grow some of these. And I sprinkle them all over my front porch, back along the lilac bushes, and behind the garage. And I think I'm getting kind of low, and I'm a liar by nature, so they're not going to believe me if I tell them I have it. Stuff them back in my pocket, they're walking in the house. And my mother dusted me, you know, higher than heaven. I went walking in the house. She told me I could get a piece of fruit. I went in the kitchen, and I got a piece of fruit. I came out, and she said, Jeanette, you're a little thief. I told you could have a orange. And I was doing a noodle dance. I mean, she's pulling that plastic bag out of my pocket, and she looked at him, and that, you know, look of absolute horror and disgust was on her face. And my aunt, who I recently saw, said she was there, and my mom just had a baby, and she said, baby, can I have those? And I'll tell you, I got what I wanted. And that's a bad thing for a kid like me, is to, you know, one of my plans to work. And that's what happened. I remember I got beat higher than heaven. And something else happened where we ended up going back to the reservation. My parents split up again. My parents were married and divorced to each other. Not once, only twice. 3 times. Okay? So this was a divorce, I think. And we were up into the hills, and we went to Brownie, went to Grandma's. We always went to Nana's when it was falling apart, and somebody tried to torch our house. You know, we'd been up there for a couple months. So my mom had to go back down to Butte. And I and my kids, we always got to go to town. We would drive 40 miles into Brownies for groceries and whatnot, and they would always put me in the car because by this time, I've smoked it. By this time, my family owns a bar in St. Mary's at Kip's Beer Garden, and I'm behind the bar. And I start out washing glasses, and it's innocent, and I'm cute, and I'm pocketing quarters for the Pac-Man machine. Pretty soon, I'm stealing bottles of wine, and I'm hanging out with my cousins. My cousins are Easting, Fat Boy, and Chubby and Dusty. And I don't have a good name. They just called me Jeanette a lot. And so we're hanging out, we're drinking down by the creek, and I got caught with my little brother down at the river, you know, drinking and smoking Camel Lights, and I loved it, and it was amazing. So of course my mom had to haul me to Butte, so she hauled me down to Butte, and it was fields of green. I don't know how long it had been. I often wonder, was it a wet spring, was it a dry summer? I mean, what were the conditions? The ones by the garage were blooming, and my mother had the fire marshal and the chief of police on the way to interview her about someone trying to torch her house, because, you know, we thought it was Dad, and she was saying it could have been, who knows. But I just remember my mom out there taking it, laughing hysterically. She had this push mower with like the rusted little blade and the wheel was hanging off, and she looked like a hooderite one. Yeah, she's going around screaming at me, and I lay down in the fields of green, and I thought, ah. Now, my mother loved me more than life itself. I promise you that my mom wished for me. She wanted a little girl, and she was sentimental, and she was very loving, and she pressed some of that in my baby book. Thanks, Mom. And I smoked it when I was 14 and on my way to my second rehab. I recommend that. But by this time, you know, I'm in Glacier, and I'm in the most beautiful part of Montana I think you can be. And next to this is absolutely quite fabulous. And I'm in heaven, and I'm drinking behind the bar, and I'm getting my grandma's chicken stoned. And I'm fighting. Like I said, I like to hit people. I like to hit things. I'll hit anything because it feels good. And I'm fighting all of the time. And you know, this one time I remember, maybe 11, maybe I'm 12 years old, I don't know, I'm down by St. Mary's River. And it's a beautiful place. It cuts right behind St. Mary's Lodge. And I'm down with my little brother. And my little brothers, I tell you what, they adore me. They really do. And they wanted nothing more than to just be with me, to hang out. Because I was their cool big sister, and I had a dirt bike that didn't have any brakes. And to stop it, I had to lay it down. You know, I mean, I loved it. My kid has a dirt bike today, but he wears a helmet. a little different. And I was out there with Arnold, and Arnold, you know, for some reason I was having a bad day, or maybe I was just having a bad morning. But I'm out there with him, and I had a couple of bottles stashed, and he reminded me of this the other day. He said, "You remember when you made me drink that wine?" Because, of course, I don't want to drink alone. I mean, come on. Don't you want to be cool like me? And he pissed me off, and we were fishing, and I had this fishing pole that had a barbed hook on it. They had the serrated hooks on it. And I remember, and you know, and I'll tell you what, this was maybe 20 years ago. I don't know, it was a long time. And he was describing it for us the other night. He said I could just hear it cutting through the wind. And I was swinging it at him, telling him, "Get away from me, back up, leave me alone." And I caught him right in the lip. And I didn't let go of the fishing pole. And he was screaming to high heaven, and my mom came running out of the house. And, you know, what I remember is after that is that they had to fly him to Alberta. They had to fly him up over the border to have it surgically removed. And I'll tell you, I wish that I could stand here today and tell you that hit my forestep and that I remember that incident, but it did not. Because I suffer from perpetual forgetfulness, okay? Hi, how you doing? I'm back. It's great. It's wonderful. And thank you for the grace in the program that I got to drink a few more years after that, because I needed to. You know, all of the destruction, all the harm I caused with those little boys, and I'll tell you what, I just spent the last week juggling time slots, trying to see them all, because for some reason they wanted to be with me. I don't know what that is, but it was fabulous, and I'm very, very grateful. So after that happened, we moved back down to Helena. I was in Helena, I was in the big city, and I'm Indian. And I'm the wrong color, you know, and I talk funny. And I hated these people. You know, I could not stand. I'd stand in the halls of Helena Junior High, and by this time I'm already making a little profit on the side, selling some of the accelerants that I was using as I was drinking. I don't know the way to phrase that, but yes, I was doing. And I was in the eighth grade. So by the time my freshman summer rolled around, my parents had already had me committed for a psych evaluation, and now when I'm 10 years old, they're taking me to a psychiatric facility, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, standing appointments at 3 o'clock after school. What is wrong with her? You know, most importantly, what do we have to do to make her right? I mean, I really believe that was their intention, and that was their best hope, that they wanted nothing more than to have me just be complete and okay and fulfilled. Those people loved me. I am not kidding you. I know that more than life itself, they loved me. And I was a raging maniac. I remember punching walls, and my father was a Marine, and he had those NCO swords, and my brother and I would go whipping through the house, you know, trying to cut each other. The Highlander was just on, and it was like, there can be only one, you know, and he'd be taking chunks out of my mom's woodwork in her house, and
a menace. I am a menace. I'm at the breakfast table at 8 in the morning. God have mercy. I have no idea what time it is or why I need to shut up. Help. Thank you. 5, 10, somewhere in there. Aye. Good job, man. If you're not sleeping, I would appreciate it. I told everybody in Florida, you can have a nap pass for the evening. So where was I? Was I drunk? Was I eating someone? What was I doing? Yes. So Jeff and I would just be rocking out to Metallica in our room, and I was on probation by this time, of course, and my mom and my dad would have family meetings, and they were trying really hard to build some kind of core family values, and we just sabotaged it every round. And it's 8 o'clock in the morning, my little brother's crunching Captain Crunch at the breakfast table, and I'm like, shut up, shut up! You know, and my mom's trying to flip eggs over there, you know, and they were trying to do the non-confrontational, you know, love, I don't know, they should just whack me over the head with the frying pan. I was just a monster, and I can remember my freshman year in high school, walking down the halls of Helena High, and man, those kids just, like Moses parting the Red Sea, man, they backed up. And, you know, I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to be a cheerleader. I wanted to be a jock. I wanted to be all of those things. I just couldn't follow through with it, you know. I had that grand idea of being, you know, Billy Mills or something. It didn't happen. What happened is I started getting arrested a lot. And that's one of the things that Stephanie and I have in common, is that I am most comfortable like this. To this day, this works for me. I can even sit this way for long periods of time, believe it or not. Because there are many times they were very, very angry with me. So my poor mom, she's got this crazy drunken kid and this crazy drunken husband, and, you know, we were just raging through the town of Helena, and, you know, I have this absolute, one of my favorite drunks was, I gotta have enough. I don't know about you, but I gotta have enough. I had 2 suitcases of Rainier California coolers when it came in a 2-liter bottle, and about a half, maybe a Mickey half kind of Lake Calvert. And I'm just all about the octane mixture. I don't care what it tastes like, because I just want it to feel good, and I will drink anything, trust me, absolutely anything. I tried taking my dad's nitroglycerin myself one time because I was desperate. I drank rubbing alcohol, vanilla extract. When your mom puts on the mental ward, you got to do something. Because they weren't medicating me, although I really needed it. I was drinking vanilla extract, almond extract, rum extract, and I'd go in there and I would say, I'm getting those cookies for some really meeting, you know, and call them to the kitchen. And in the hospital, they have like industrial sized bottles, you know. So I try to convince my friends to bring me up, I tried getting Carmen to bring me up some booze on the top of John's cup. I'm like, sit by the door, nobody will know, because you can bring me up like my last meal before I shift out for rehab again. God bless that woman, I'll tell you what, but one of the last ones that I can remember is I was out at the fairgrounds, and I had, Amanda was with me, and I had stolen a car, and I'm really good for stealing cars. I don't know how to hotwire a car, I know how to steal purses and get your keys, and that's what I did. You know, I got this car, and I ended up down at the fairgrounds, and it's that feeling when Bill talks about in the book that he reflected with that certain sense of satisfaction that he had enough to carry him through the evening, and I sat there with my case of beer, because I'm always planned and prepared. That's the one thing that I do, and I'm quite organizational in that sense. I can plan it. I can coordinate events well. Got to have enough beer. And when I show up to the party, one of the main things that I make sure that I have is, like, I'm going to find out where the stash is. The washer is always a good place. Fill it up with cold water or some snow if it's winter in Montana, and you throw beer in there, and then when you go upstairs and drink everybody else's beer, you get to go back down to the laundry room, have your own, come back up, drink your beer. You know, I'm not a sharer. I'm really not. I'm a pretty spoon hogger. That's what I am. But, you know, if you have some you want to share with me or else. So I'll tell you what, I'm drunk, I'm out at the fairgrounds, and I remember this cop coming in, and just, be, you know, when you're that drunk, what do you care? Arrest me. You know, send me home, I'm 15, what are you going to do to me? Take away my birthday? And I would have, they'd take me home, they'd stand me in front of my mom, and they'd be like, how can you do this to her? How can you do that? Your life, your potential. There's always the power of potential, positive power of thinking, you know. Don't you want to be something when you grow up? And I have been in inside awareness classes, chemical awareness classes, my whole entire life. I feel that I'm educated beyond my capacity when it comes to drugs and alcohol. Move over it, let me help you out, you're going to hurt somebody here, you know, and that's what I was doing. We'd sign contracts, and then I started trying to kill myself, and, you know, all the chaos and all the happenings happened, you know, but more importantly, I really had a good time drinking. I really did. And I will pay the price. I will take the consequence. I will take the beating. I really will. It is worth it. And no matter whose heart I break, and no matter that my mom's standing in front of me just like, what is wrong with you? And I just remember screaming at her, I'm evil! I didn't ask to be born! You know, I'm writing the lyrics from Metallica, you know, Fade to Black in my blood, and I'm stabbing them into my bedroom wall with, you know, nails and knives and stuff. And she's got her children, and, you know, and, oh, it was awful. I often tell people, my mother, you know, I am the girl that your mother warned you about, because my mother was warning you about me. She really was. She was like, if you go out with Jeanette tonight, you are responsible for your own actions. Tell your mother not to call me. Because she would be fielding phone calls all the time about what Jeanette had done with her child again. And I started getting that. I was like, if you can't run with the big dogs, stay off the porch. And so this is going to go down. Something's going to happen. If there's going to be a wet t-shirt contest, I'm going to have a no t-shirt contest, and I'm going to win. You know, if we're going to go out to the lake, we're getting in the lake. You know, you just, it's going to happen. And my friend Carmen said that to me one time. She said, Jeanette, I'm really, really, really glad you're sober, but God, I miss how crazy you were. You know, nobody drug me around this town like you did. And I swelled with pride, you know. But unfortunately, at 3 o'clock in the morning when I want to kill myself or one of you, you know, it's not happening and it's not there. And I really do, you know, I feel like I'm here by mistake because I don't have this, you know, tremendous moving story of how I got sober. It happened by mistake. Truly it did. It was an absolute accident, because all that I know is I was in a lot of trouble. I get in trouble a lot. Did I ever tell you that? So one of these many times I was in trouble, and I was going to send me to the girls' school. And I don't like girls particularly. And I don't want to go to the girls' school. I don't think that sounds like a good idea. So I'll do anything to get out of going to the girls' school. And I said, well, you can go to this drug and alcohol treatment program. It's in Seattle, Washington, or Tacoma, Washington, rather. And it was a 28-day program. I'm all over that. You get, sign me up. Where do we go? Now, as I'm driving there, 611 pathetic miles with my parents locked in the back seat, you know, I'm thinking, this is not, Mountain View were kind of good, because I could run from Mountain View. I am off of K Street in Tacoma, where the real deal's going on. And I'm not kidding you, I am this scared little kid in the back of this car going, oh my God, I take it back. Please don't leave me here. Please stay in with my mother. Don't leave me here. How can you do this to me? And she dumped me off at that door. They brought me there at 2 o'clock in the morning. They were so desperate to get rid of me and walked me in there. And I'll never forget it. You know, the little watch nurse or whatever said, we can't take her tonight. My dad said, you have to take her. She's like, no, we have admission starting at 6 in the morning. He's, you know, he looked at me and he looked at my mom. He's like, what are we going to do? Go home. You know, that's okay. We can take it back. We can change our minds. I'll be better. I promise. And all of a sudden, that day, I was crying in my mother's lap. Please don't do this to me. And we ended up out at Bremerton. And this is really important, because I stood in that cafeteria, that treatment center that night at, like, the General Hospital, and the 12 steps and the 12 traditions were on the wall, and there was a, you know, a fluorescent light, and, like, it was flickering on and coming off and flickering on and coming off, and it was just kind of beamed right on the second step. You know, it was him to believe that a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. And I'll tell you what, the breath I had been holding my whole life came out, that somebody else knew that I was insane. And I was like, oh, all right. We went out to Bremerton. We were at Naval Shipyard. My dad, of course, being a former Marine, locked me up. I watched Head to Knee Ball and smoked a lot of cigarettes and watched the Mothball Fleet, which is where the surrender to the Second World War was signed, one of those ships, the USS Missouri. And I watched those ships floating out there in that yard. And I'll tell you what, they are 3 football fields long, and they are a football field and half wide, and they float on the water. And I remember thinking, you know, if that ship could float, maybe I could too. And to this day, I do not understand buoyancy, and please don't explain it to me, because it was in that innocence that I got my first hope that maybe I didn't have to drink. We didn't have to live the way that I was living. I didn't know any of that, because savvy and cool as I am just here because they're making me be. You know, and I'm trying to prove to them I'm not alcoholic. So I went to 58 days of treatment. and they told me I was going to have to write a 4th step before I got out of that residential treatment center. That did not happen, because I will wear you out. Not happening. I'm not doing that. Thank you very much. Next. I'll do something else with some flair and, you know, smoke, leave me alone. So Jim, you get a sponsor and go to AA. And I remember the only person that I knew that was in Alcoholics Anonymous was a woman who a year prior had come and spoke at my school, and her name was Ann, and many of you know Ann. Ann was my first sponsor, and Ann I drank with. Ann took me out when I was in the fifth grade and got me slammed. Love her for that to this day, man. In the eighth grade, I saw her at a party, and she had had a baby. And my God, a DUI. And I thought, ooh, back up, Ann. Can't. that's when you're like really alcoholic, you know, the DUI. If you learn how to drive drunk in a stolen car, you won't get arrested. Because that's my experience. And I'm sticking by it. So what ended up happening is I knew Ann, and I think I wrote her some cheesy letter or something. I don't know. Because what happened in the spring of 87 is Ann came, or spring of 88 rather, Ann came to my school. And she was making amends to the instructor there. You know, she and I both got kicked out of alternative. And I remember her coming in, and she was just radiant. You know, it was what Bill talked about. There was something inexplicably different about her eyes. You know, she was beaming. And again, this is a woman carried around a purse you can fit a six-pack in. And I thought that was so cool. And she talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she talked about her life. And she had another woman with her who was 6 months sober, and her name was Margaret. Many of you know Margaret. And I remember looking back, you know, when I was about 3 years sober, I thought they were 10 months and 6 months sober. They were no newcomers. They could have killed me. You know, but they were on fire and enthusiastic and doing the deal. And they, no one, I know that nobody was more perfectly suited to save my own life. They really were. They were desperate and they wanted to be sober, and I was their victim. And that's what happened. I really just got drugged here against my own will, kicking and screaming the whole way. I didn't want to come here and meditate or levitate or whatever you're going to give me. Did I want what you have? No, thank you. Divorces, stretch marks, I'll pass. You know, I just want to be off probation. I want to go out after 6 o'clock at night. That's what I want. I want to be where the boys are, okay? Oh, there's a boy room. I'm staying. So, and that's pretty much what happened. I'll tell you what, I got out of treatment that second time, and I ended up in the Alamo Club on a Friday night meeting, and the woman said to me, she said, you know, we're going to coffee afterwards, and for some reason I just went with her. And I've watched the recovery group in action as I have watched my own group in action. I have watched how you just take the battered, broken person and my tag team them, you know, up against the ropes, driving to the restaurant. The next thing you know, they have a big look. The next thing you know, they're looking you in the eye and not, you know, and on and on and on. And the miracle and the magic happens of what we know here is recovery. And that's what they did for me. Those women, as ugly and awful as I tried to be, because I got here with the Metallica medal up your shirt on. In the context, is that what I say? Okay. And had a cuss on the podium. It's a new thing. Ripped up shredded jeans. I had a mohawk. It was hot pink and blonde. And I remember Carlene saying to me that I was a piece of work when I got here, and I thought that that meant I was looking good. Because I had it going on. I was wrecked. I couldn't sit still. I remember everything on my body was moving, and she would sit by people, and I'd be like, how could you never sit by me? You always sit by everybody else. And she's like, baby, you are moving the room. And I would pinch myself in meetings and I'd sit there going, oh my God, when's he going to shut up? I hate those shoes. Oh God, I hate that. He needs shoes. You know, all of this stuff going on in my head, and da 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 da. You know, it's happening, and it's like a Metallica conference, and a Shriners conference, and a Stampede, and a livestock auction, and a baby shower. It's all going on. Right now. And it's like, how do you deal with that? And that woman sat down with me with the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, do you have a big book? I said, yes, ma'am, I do. You know what? She said, you do? Yeah, I got a big book in October of 1987. I was up on the psych ward. There was a lady up there who was 3 years sober. Don't ask me what she was doing on the psych ward with me. And she was there, and I took her book, and I took a book from the library, and I highlighted and I underlined everything she had in the book, and I wrapped it up in a pair of dress jeans. I put it in a patient's belonging bag. I called my mother and said, get up there right now, and she did. I handed her the bag. I said, take this home, put it in my closet, don't look in it, and she did. And I remember stumbling in my closet one night because I had no furniture in my room because I'd broken it all in a fit of rage, and I found that bag, and I went, dude, there's those jeans, and there's that book. What's that book? So when Ann picked herself up off the floor, she said, read the doctor's opinion. And my book was stamped throughout. And all the pivotal pages, 25, 35, 63, psychiatric department, St. Peter's Community Hospital, lest I forget where I come from. Read the doctor's opinion, she said. So I read the doctor's opinion. I read the doctor's opinion, so the sun came up the next day. I read the doctor's opinion. I thought that she wanted chapter outline, book report, what I had to do, you know, always highlight, underline. And I asked her, and I started following the two boys at the halfway house. And she said, when I saw her, how did she stop me? I don't know. How did she know where I was at? She said, did you read the doctor's opinion? I'll tell you what, two of my other heads came out. And I said, yes, I did. I don't understand. And she said, good. Then you're changeable. Oh, sure, great, wonderful. What? Be at my house Tuesday at 6:30. And that's what I did. I went to her house. We went through about a page at a time, a sentence at a time. She completely defined words for me that I found. My husband always says, having a grown person read to you in public, you can find it a little bizarre. But I did it, and I nodded a lot. She seemed happy when I did that. I kind of feel like I was in a wind tunnel, you know, like, you know, obsession. Oh, I got that. You know, and all of these definitions. And I'll tell you what, I really am not the rocket of sobriety that I know. I have just a tedious, tedious, monotonous program of action. That's what's happened to me. I followed what that woman told me to do. And a lot of the times I didn't. You know, I can remember coming to meetings, and I'll never forget it. I was invited to speak at my home group when I was 3 years sober, and this is the condition I was in. I showed up in a t-shirt and a pair of shorts, and the greeters were greeting in jackets. And I thought, gotta go. And I don't know how I even ever got to that talk, and hopefully they had burned that tape long ago, but I got pregnant shortly thereafter, so that'll tell you what happened. Because if you don't make your amends and use birth control, that will happen to you. I'm just warning you now, Stephanie. but I'm a little late for this one. Anybody else? We got to that. we made a baby, and that was 14 years ago this year. And that was one of the things that often broke my heart about not getting to come to Bear Sleep, is that I had this little baby, and, you know, by the time that baby was old enough to leave him with grandma, I had another little baby, and the same thing, and now the baby is 5, and here I am. And again, I trust you, I just, it's a dream I never knew I had. I look at my life a lot of times, and I cannot believe this is happening. I just want to, like, yell fire or something, you know, like, can you believe we're here? We are a room full of 1,000 miracles, of moments and magic and time of when it just happens. You know, you can't define it, you can't put your finger on it, you don't know when it did, but it happened for you that you made it to this room tonight. And that's huge. Because I'll tell you what, life is expensive. Life is expensive for everybody. For the guy down the street, for the beautiful man who gets to ranch this mountain, it's expensive. Breathing in and out, paying taxes, learning and loving. But for us, it is priceless. Because you can't buy sobriety. I live in a town where there's a lot of flash and a lot of excitement, and I'll tell you what, they have to come to AA to get sober. There's nowhere else we can go. And that, at some point, is all that I wanted from you. I just didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. I didn't want to have to cut on myself, punch walls, beat people up. I didn't want to have to live that way anymore. You know, I am truly, my sister and I are like the only women in our family with all of our teeth. You know, I went to the res the other day, I was showing the girls where you said, oh, keep you creeping, and facing them Indian boys. And I can't believe it. I can't believe that I have a driver's license, and I have life insurance. Do you know that? Is that weird or what? So I'll tell you that Anne really, she showed up with me, and the women in Alcoholics Anonymous showed up with me, and they taught me how to sit still and how to put all my clothes on, and at some point leave the boys alone. You know, and I got to participate in my life and in my recovery, and I got to slowly start to give back at what, you know, we have been given here. And the truth of the matter is that I am far better than I deserve. I really am, and I'm just as grateful as I know how to be for that. And I can't, you know, the one thing that keeps weighing heavy on my heart is I want to tell you a story about my dad. I love my father more than life itself, and my dad and I got sober in 1988 together, and he was sober for 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. We shared this program. We had amazing hope and healing in our family. As you well know what that's like, we had radiant days. You know, and even the heartaches were better than they ever were drunk. And when we were 10 years sober, my father got drunk. And I didn't know when he got drunk. I had no idea because my family hid it from me. All that I knew is that he was all of a sudden moving to Ecuador. My dad had 3 families on 2 continents. He's a busy boy. And I remember that when he left, I had just moved back to Montana. Jason and I were at Beat Tech and going to school, and he left his MCO sort with me, and he left some safety deposit stuff and a few other things. And I remember having a talk with him about his funeral, what he wanted, and, you know, that he wanted to be cremated and all this stuff. And he had, you know, in the transcript of that stuff, he wasn't doing yeah. And I didn't really write down a lot of it, but I have a gist of it, you know, and I can kind of remember. And my father had a chronic heart condition. He had two open heart children at St. Louis, you know, that where the recovery group really rallied and showed up with us at that time. And so my dad left the country, and he ended up going to Ecuador. And in March of 2004, he told me that he was no longer going to continue medical care for his condition, and that he was tired, and that the road had been long, you know, but he was done. And the words that came out of my mouth were, "Dad, I respect you, you know, and thank you for telling me." But what my actions were is that SOB no good, you know, dirty dog. And I stopped talking to him, not on purpose at first. It's hard to get out of country lines. You know, and he has a baby, he's with a new family down there, and he's got another baby girl. And I listen to all the crap my head tells me about, you know, remember when and when that happened, and he did this to me, and fail to report that to my sponsor. Because when I am under attack, I usually call and say, "I'm under attack." And I didn't. And I think I mentioned to her that year, I said, "You know, I didn't send my dad a Father's Day card this year. That was no big deal, you know." And she said, "You need to send that card." And I didn't. You know, and by August, by about my birthday, I was kind of getting a little burning in my stomach of like, ooh, not really sure what it is. Maybe it's my diet. Soda pop, I don't know. It's just that ache when you know you're off. Because I know that I'm off. I have a great celebration. I used to live in fear every day of my life. And I don't today because of you people in this program. And when I did that, I know. I couldn't put my finger on it. And a week after my 16th sobriety birthday, my father died in a bar in Monta, Ecuador. It was called the Memphis Bell. And he had the big one. He had his first heart attack at 36 and his last one at 54. And when that call came through, I wish I could tell you that I was current and that I was complete and that I stand here before you a good, disciplined daughter in AA, but I was not. I tried getting a hold of my sponsor. I got a hold of Teresa, screaming to high heaven on the side of the road in West Texas that my dad was dead. And she said, "Oh my God, Jeanette, it was 10 years ago today that my dad died." And I'm so grateful for that parallel, and I'm so grateful for the gift of identification, because I had hope that if, you know, and I remember what I said to her was not, "Oh, thank God." I said, "I'm too young to be a part of a dead dad club." But I didn't live that way, right? I did, and I didn't honor that man as he deserved and as was suggested to me in this program. And it took about 14 days to recover his body from a foreign country. A couple of hurricanes happened. They shut down Miami, and it was, it was a mess. We got his body home, and we had an amazing funeral, which Alcoholics Anonymous just, I mean, that's why it happened. It happened because my sponsor, my home group, and the newcomers showed up in a tie. That's what happened. And I was able to honor him, and I was able to participate in his death in a way I wouldn't have been able to. You know, I made sure that he had everything that he needed in farewell. We had an amazing ceremony. We had about 4 bald eagles fly over his burial site. It was, you know, it was the way it should have been. But what happened when I got home that evening, I remember sitting there with my husband feeling, I've never known pain like that, drunk or sober, feeling like I wanted to die. I thought, I have his sword. You know, he left that with me. And what I can tell you is that my father gave me my inheritance before he died. He passed on to me that which I was to have to honor him, you know, after he left this world. And so I promise you, but if you take these actions, whether your parents are alive or dead, the freedom that I have today is the fact that I call my mother. My mother right now is at my house. You know, I call my mother every chance that I get. You know, I buy her chocolate and black jelly beans, and I listen to her talk to me about the powwow, and I'm like, okay, you know, when's it going to end? But she was my last connection to that man, because they shared an amazing, passionate love, to which I am so very grateful, because I would not stand in here before you without that. You know, so I tell you what, I'm glad that you stayed awake. I don't know if I'm done, but I feel like I'm near the end. Richard stayed awake, thank God. I think he nodded once, but he drove me up here. Once we got the big timber. I don't know where I'm at, but I do know that there's a lot of women that I sponsor in this room, and that there's a lot of people here who have watched me get sober and continue to help me stay sober. And all that I can tell you is I thank you for my life, and I love you all.